routed there, Eric, go ahead.
Well, as far as I know, ABC is still, the master control is still in New York. But then again, I could be wrong about that. I don't work for them. And I try to keep up with what everybody's doing, but you never know. And this brings us to the whole thing about Internet, IP, and TCP. Don't forget, this system was developed by DARPA, or ARPA actually, originally, as a self-healing network. Meaning that if a path between, say, Los Angeles and New York and somewhere in Ohio, the path gets broken, the system figures out, oh, well, maybe you'll go down to Tennessee first and then make another connection to West Virginia and then get to New York. It's a self-healing network. It finds the path for you, even if you don't have a complete path from one place to another. And this is the method in which your cell phone system operates, and it operates as TCP/IP. So this magic thing that we've created that people call the Internet is actually this outgrowth of this protocol that creates what's called a self-healing network, and that's why it continues to work. And then this station in Hawaii getting their signal from New York, if somehow or other their path breaks down, another path is found for them, and that's why you get really good continuous service. Yeah, it breaks once in a while, but it's usually not because of the self-healing network. It's usually at the terminal gear. So, get your IW, King 2 Giant.
Well done. By the way, for a short period of time, your transmission had a crackle, crackle, crackle sound to it. It went to the input, and it wasn't there. You're not doing it. So there was a crackle, crackle coming out of the machine for a brief period of time. Although I'm still doing it at times, I know. We've come a long way. I can remember when cell phones were just starting to become popular. Let's see, the cell phone, one of the major inventors, from my point of view, is Dr. Reed Fisher, Bell Labs, W2CQH, Whiskey 2, Charlie, Quebec Hotel, working at Bell Labs, Murray Hill, I think it was, 1968. He was describing this system to me in 69, 70, the cell phone system. And it became popular about 10 years later. So I can remember on some of the TechNet of roughly 1995 or so, I was saying the day will come. Let me drop it. I remember on a couple of those TechNets predicting that the day will come that a person with modern-day cell phone-like equipment will be standing in New Zealand watching a beautiful sunrise or sunset. And I said the person will take a picture with his camera of this beautiful sunrise or sunset, interconnected to his cell phone, and by slow scan TV or whatever, call his buddy up in Los Angeles, forgive him for, please ask him to forgive him for calling him up at 3 o'clock in the morning, but saying, you're such a close friend of mine, I'm having this, my wife and I are having this very strong emotional response here in New Zealand, and I want you to see what we are experiencing. I remember saying that around 1995, making a prediction. Now, when it comes to selfie pictures or whatever, and the fact that the camera is built into the phone, and the camera's got an electronic zoom and a mechanical zoom and whatever, and all kinds of data, and texting and whatever, we've left that prediction in the dust a long time ago. But here we are with terrible conditions in Florida. And I'm watching ABC television and NBC and CBS and PIX and whatever, and Channel 5, flipping around all of them to watch what's going on. By the way, the best radar pictures of what's going on in Florida were on Channel 41, the Spanish-speaking station. And although I couldn't understand what they're saying, let me drop it. When they gave you a display with numbers, you could recognize the speed of the wind and the speed of the gusts and whatever. The major difference is that on the Spanish-speaking station, they don't tell you the air pressure in millibars. They give it to you in kilopascals. So they use pascals instead of millibars. Everything else is the same. But they gave beautiful radar pictures. High resolution, continuous radar pictures with somebody continuously talking in Spanish, explaining what you're seeing. I almost didn't need that. So if I wanted to see live pictures of the radar, and I could tell there's a major radar in Homestead, I could see the scanning of that radar telling you what's going on. Now, part of my interest, let me drop this, is that my brother, my younger brother, he's 11 years younger than me. My younger brother, for the last 30 some odd years, has lived in Boca Raton, Florida, with his family, two adult sons and an adult daughter, all living in his house in Boca Raton, rough guess, 5,000 square feet. But he's 13 feet above sea level, 2.9 miles from the Atlantic Ocean in Boca Raton. And Boca Raton was predicted to get a pretty strong flood water. Whether or not that got to his house is something to worry about a little bit. But something to worry about a hot lot more is my cousin living in Naples, Florida. Their house is 7/10 of a mile from the Gulf of Mexico. Their land is 3 feet above sea level. And they're predicted to get a 10 to 15 foot flood water in Naples. Naples, they think, is going to be one of the hardest hit towns in Florida. And I was really worried about whether or not my cousin and her husband evacuated. The good news is that a week and a half ago, they went on a cruise to Canada, and they're on that ship as we speak. But what's going to happen to their house? If they get 10 to 15 feet of water above ground level, there's going to be an awful lot of damage to that very nice house in Naples, Florida. So two of my close, essentially blood relatives, are really being hit with Florida right now. So I was watching these radar sites and whatever.
Repeater, time out.
And so the real hard hit to Naples and the major town, the port town north of that, I can't think of the name of it right now, they are, the major hit was going to take place after the TechNet began. So is anybody within the sound of my voice, can they tell me how many feet of water in that backflow did take place in Naples? Does anybody know? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW,
the TechNet. K2IW, K2J. Well, actually, my house is further north than Naples. We're kind of worried about it, but we're about 8 feet above sea level, and we're sitting on a canal, but we're about 2 miles in from the Gulf, but there's water in the backyard, so we don't know what's actually happening. Just turning around, looking to see, Miami's still flooded, so that's part of the course, but on the West Coast, I haven't seen anything yet, and I'm sure the wife is glued to the weather channel. There's actually a couple of weather channels that have really good radar, but we'll see.
Very fine, Eric. What's the name of that major seaport city? Oh, about 40 or so miles north of... Was that again?
Tampa.
Yeah, Tampa. Tampa has had a lot of flooding just from good rainstorms in the past. I think an awful lot of Tampa is only 3 feet above sea level. So both Naples and Tampa, by way of Hurricane Irma, are predicted to get an awful lot of backflow of water. I can't think of the right word for it. You know what I mean. What do they call that? When the tail end of the... When the eye has passed over you and the tail end of it passes over you, all of a sudden there's a whole lot of water, flood water, that pushes in. What's that called, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, the last pictures I saw before the TechNet was Tampa Bay was basically dry. All that water got sucked out. And as the hurricane comes in, as the eyeball passes and you have the wind blowing in the other direction, you're essentially going to get this little mini tsunami heading at you.
You're looking for flood surge, Dick WSLN.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. So that's the flood surge. They were predicting 10 to 15 feet could occur in Naples, and later on tonight, when the storm finally gets up to Tampa, I think Tampa is going to have similar grief. And it'd be interesting to find out what your wife has seen so far, Eric. Maybe you're not at the health QTH. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I just saw a radar picture. It looks like your eye is pretty much undefined at this point, but it looks like it's around Fort Myers, a little bit north of there. But yeah, they're expecting a flood surge, but I don't know. With Tampa Bay is getting empty like it is, you can imagine what the other direction is going to be like.
Yeah, thank you. A person who said comment, please give us your full call and name. And go right ahead with your comments, sir. K2RIW.
Hello, Dick. Hello, Eric, George, KD2FIU. And what I heard a little while ago from officials in Tampa, I heard this on the television, the hit is going to be greater than the largest one that they had 90 years ago on record.
Good information, George. Now, I think you're talking about Tampa, which has had a lot of flood problems with just heavy rainstorms. And so when it comes to this major hurricane hitting Tampa, I think that's a rather rare event. And so was there any specific information, George, about Naples? Because Naples was also predicted to get an awful lot of flood water. Back to you, George. KQRIW and the TechNet.
What I heard, and I heard this on ABC News, there was one quick commentary from somebody coming down there, coming up from down there, that it was leaving Naples, the heaviest of it was leaving Naples, and the officials in Tampa were saying that this hit will be greater than what is the biggest one they have on record 90 years ago. That's including wind, rain, and surge.
Okay, so it looks like it's still in the process of happening. Has it been downgraded, do you think, George, to a Category 2 storm? Over to you, George.
In Category 2 for the last 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah, that's still an awful lot of rain, an awful lot of wind. And when the eye passes over you, at the end of that eye, you get a lot of high wind coming onshore as opposed to offshore. But sometime after that is this a backflow of water. Anybody have any further comments, please give me a call. Let us know. K2RIW. Okay. Anybody have any further information as to what's coming out of Florida? One more call. Can anybody tell us what they know about the west coast of Florida and Hurricane Irma? Give me a call. That is K2RIW. According to what we've seen on the news so far, a medium amount of flooding, a few feet of flooding in Miami. And they thought the flooding was going to be a hell of a lot worse on the west coast. It'd be nice to find out that the predictions were pessimistic and it didn't get that bad yet. We'll soon find out. I think it's time to go over to the space report, WS2N. The space report number 267, K2RIW. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. And, a few things that are new, but we'll cover something I tried to cover last week, but I kind of glossed over it a little bit. Was a flight that is going to be taking off in May of next year called InSight. And InSight is going to go to Mars, basically study the interior of Mars. And they're going to land right on the equator. And InSight stands for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesic, and Transport. Basically, they're bringing up a seismometer that's going to be encapsulated in this sphere made of titanium that it's got such a strong vacuum in it that they had trouble with it 2 years ago. This thing was supposed to launch in 2016, but now it's going up in 2018. This thing was being manufactured by a company involved with the French space organization called CNES, and they were having trouble with this vacuum trying to keep it sealed from dropping. Tried a number of fixes a couple of years ago, and it didn't work out, so they turned it over to JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they managed to work on this, create a perfect vacuum. After they land on Mars with this InSight, it's a stationary vehicle. It's just got three legs, no wheels or anything, but it does have an arm. It's going to pick up the sphere and put the sphere on the surface of Mars. So I haven't figured out how the seismometer, which is inside this thing, is going to operate. Physics behind it. But that's what they have to do. They have to separate it from the spacecraft and just let it sit on the surface. And then they have another thing that they're going to also take off the spacecraft and put onto the surface. And it's a self-drilling mechanism that's going to drill down about 10 feet or 3 meters into the surface. And at the bottom of this, they're going to have some kind of a way of measuring the temperature, some kind of a thermometer, so it's probably a thermistor of some sort. And they want to measure the interior temperature. And then the third mechanism of looking at the interior of the spacecraft is using radio waves. They're going to transmit radio waves back to Earth, and they're going to be able to tell the exact distance between the spacecraft and Earth, and they can find out if it wobbles or moves one way or the other. And this way they're going to try to discern the core of the planet somehow by that method, finding out how much of a solid core or any kind of a liquid core that might be left inside of Mars. So inside, I'm looking forward to that. It's a pretty long spacecraft when the solar panels are opened up. It's a little over 20 feet, one end to the other. And they're going to be round solar panels. They're going to open up like a fan. And very similar to the Phoenix lander that landed back in 2007. Looks like that design. So it's expected to last a couple of years. And they're going to do a lot of research. But I was interested in the RF part of the system. I think it's going to be similar to what Voyager is doing. I think they're going to send the signal to the spacecraft, and then that signal indirectly will be sent back. I think that's how they're going to measure the exact distance between the two spacecraft. My guess is that's probably what they're going to do. But as time goes on, I'll probably find out. I'll probably read about it. This is WS-20. So that's one mission that's coming up. And another one that's existing right now is by Japan. They had sent an orbital spacecraft to Venus back in 2010. It was supposed to go into orbit, and it failed to go into orbit. The rocket engine did not come on to de-accelerate it. So the name of the spacecraft is called Akatsuka. So Akatsuka is presently actually in orbit around Venus now. It went all the way around the sun a couple of times. And about a year and a half ago, it was coming near Venus again, and they used the thrusters on the satellite to slow it down, and eventually they put it into an elliptical orbit, and it's been doing science ever since. Let me drop it. So Akatsuka is presently in orbit, and they came out with some kind of a detection method of detecting the winds going around Venus. and it came out with exactly 178 mile per hour wind. So I'm not sure the method that they're using on that, but to come up with an exact number like that is kind of odd. But they didn't expect those strong winds in the atmosphere. They knew they had some kind of wind, but not that strong. So Japan is in orbit around Venus. Last time we were in orbit around Venus, we had our spacecraft called Magellan, and that did a complete radar scan of the planet, and that lasted probably, I think, about 4 or 5 years. So they're investigating all the planets. Mercury's involved. The flight going out there in about a year or two. I think probably 1 year. Right around the same time James Webb Space Telescope gets launched. So, a lot of planets are being investigated. Of course, Earth, we have plenty of satellites, Mars, and Jupiter, we have Juno. I'm trying to keep apprised of all these orbital spacecraft. Let me drop it. Just wanted to talk about a launch coming up this Tuesday, and it should be, in fact, it will be on NASA TV. Got to try to remember to watch it. It'll be at 5:17 Eastern Time. 5:17 Eastern Time. And it'll be launched from Kazakhstan. It's a crewed space mission. So you have three people on board. You have the Russian, Alexander Miskirkin. He's the Russian commander. And he'll be taking up this time two Americans, Joe Acaba and Mark Vanderhey. So we'll have two Americans on that flight, one Russian. No European Space Agency astronaut this time. So I thought that was pretty good. That's all because of the deal Boeing made with NASA. They're actually paying for an extra seat. Each seat costs around $70 million to send somebody to the International Space Station using the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. So there's a couple other launches coming down the road, but we'll talk about that on future nets. There's one in November 10th, by Orbital ATK, and that'll be an Antares launch from Wallops Island, Virginia. So when that one goes up, I'll be bringing that up, because that is one of the flights we'll probably be able to see from Long Island. If you have a low horizon, usually it's got to be less than 15 degrees. You're better off going down by the water somewhere. You'll be able to see the engines of the Orbital ATK RS-181 engine. There's two of them in the Antares launch, and that'll be sending a Cygnus spacecraft, a cargo spacecraft, to the International Space Station. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. There's not all that much, but from what I understand, Cape Canaveral is supposed to be able to be in pretty good shape. Originally, there was some question about it because that hurricane, Irma, was going to come up the east side of the peninsula. And as time moved on, they kept looking at that European model instead of the American model, and it kept shifting it further and further west. So now it went up the western side, and it more or less kept away from Cape Canaveral. They got strong winds. They're getting a lot of, they'll probably have 100-mile-an-hour winds, I guess, maybe more. But they won't have the severe Category 4 type of winds that they thought they might have. That's pretty much it for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW, WS2S.
When Cassini commits suicide, so to speak, let's see now, there's another word they use for it. It's going to be euthanized. Cassini is going to euthanize himself. I think it's on September 15, which is this coming Friday. It was launched in 2004. There's no way that Cassini can send a picture. Well, It can send a series of pictures of what its camera sees as it enters the Saturnian atmosphere. It would sure be nice if there was some other satellite in just the right spot in orbit around Saturn that could aim its camera at Cassini as it does this mission. Of course, that's impossible. Just like, let me drop. On good science fiction, you can have a picture of the Earth, the solar system, our galaxy. There's no way to set up a camera to do that, if you know what I mean. So, to your knowledge, is NASA going to have something on NASA Select, for instance, just telling you what the instrumentation is telling them as Cassini does this self-euthanization this coming Friday, September 15th? Over to you, Paul, WS2N-K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they know, I'm sure they have something on. I haven't looked, but I'm sure they will. They know that Cassini's last picture, they know the exact time that's going to be, probably early in the day on the 15th. And then they're going to leave all the science instruments on, and as it gets closer to the atmosphere, I think about 2,000 miles up, it's going to really start to get a lot of turbulence. They're going to be firing the thrusters. There's still gas left in the, there's hydrazine fuel left in the thrusters, so they still have the ability to keep the antenna pointing toward Earth. The camera will be off, but all the other instruments will be on, and it'll be sending information. It'll be holding itself in the direction of Earth as it enters the atmosphere. And as it gets more and more rough, it'll get to the point where the rockets won't be able to do that anymore. And it'll start turning, and once the antenna turns away, that will be the end, and then it will break up and just burn them right up. And yeah, as far as 2004, that was when it went into orbit. Let me drop it. Launch, I believe, 1997 by, they had a Titan 4 rocket, Titan 3, that's the one that they used with the Voyagers and Viking and the Helios missions and Ulysses. They used that 7 launches, and then they went to the Titan 4 with Cassini. It had 2 big solid boosters on it. And on top, right behind the spacecraft, they had their reliable Centaur RL-10 hydrogen, oxygen second stage. And that really worked well. Got them all the way to Cassini 7 years later. Went into orbit 2004 and stayed there all that time. And they kept getting an extended mission. Originally they were hoping for 3 years, another 3 years, 2 years, and so on and so forth. And here we are in 2017. And now they would have kept it going if it didn't run out of fuel. I think it made some 125, 127 passes of tight, close passes. So they got a lot of information from that planet. It found out it had big plumes of gas coming out of an Enceladus, that other moon, probably filled with water, another ice-filled moon. Eventually, we'd like to send another spacecraft there to go in close to one of those plumes that are coming out of that moon and analyze to see if there's any organic material that's in the future. So that should be a pretty good launch. As far as seeing another spacecraft from another planet, they have done that with Mars. When actually two flights, Curiosity went in, and when the Mars Polar Lander, no correction, that was the Phoenix and Phoenix landers. Those two, Phoenix lander and the Curiosity. When they launch and then they go into the atmosphere, they have heat shields, and eventually they open up these big 1,000-square-foot, whatever they are, I forget how big they are, but parachutes. So they have pictures of the parachutes, those two flights, entering the Mars atmosphere. And it was taken from MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's been in orbit around Mars for a very long time. But that has been done, so you have raw pictures. You can find them on the internet of parachute going into Mars atmosphere. Back to you, Dick, WS2.
Who is that?
Contact.
Go right ahead.
KD2FIU, just a little update here. Working HF emergency contacts into Florida on 40 meters 7262. Local contact is WB2DCU, Delta Charlie Uniform. With the Red Cross available, in contact there. So 7262 on 40 meters is emergency traffic into Florida if anybody has any contacts they need to make. Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU.
I thank you for that information, George. The Cassini spacecraft, Paul, is that nuclear powered or does that have solar cells? Part of why I'm asking that question is I wonder how aerodynamically neutral is the Cassini spacecraft when it starts hitting the Jovian atmosphere. I mean, if it's got a rod sticking out way off to one side because there's a nuclear power supply in the end, well, that's going to act like a flag. And it's going to force the steering. And if it's got solar panels, they're a great aerodynamic drag. So I'm going to guess that Cassini has nuclear. In the case of Voyager, it flew by Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus. Flew by those and got a gravity assist. Let me drop. But except for some minor course correction, it didn't have to use any fuel. Whereas in the case of Cassini going to Jupiter, it probably approached Jupiter's gravity field and started sinking into it, and probably went up to, I'm going to pick a number, 30,000 miles an hour. And then it had to use a whole lot of retro burn to go into orbit around Jupiter. And that's where a lot of its fuel was lost. That's why it has a finite life. Launched in 1997, that was 20 years ago. So is Cassini nuclear or solar panels, and how aerodynamically neutral do you think it is? WS2N, K2RIW, Red Bull.
Yeah, that's nuclear. That's got an RTG on it. And, whatever problems it has, trying to keep itself pointed in the right direction with the antenna back to Earth is going to be the goal. So it's about to go one way or the other way. Spacecraft will know about it, and it will adjust with the thrusters, and they can already have enough gas on board to, they're going to be using the lower thrusters. They have low thrusters and high thrusters, and then they'll use the high ones when it gets a little closer, and it gets a little bit more out of control. And there haven't been all that many. I mean, they say there's like 20, but there's probably a couple of military ones that I didn't know about. But you had the two Pioneer ones. They were RTG. You had the two Voyager ones. They were also RTG. Let me drop it.
My guess is anything beyond Saturn, you have no choice but to be RTG. You'd need an acre of solar cells with so little solar power out there. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anything past Jupiter. And at one time, Jupiter was, you know, off the books, too, but they got better with the solar cell. So, you know, you had Galileo around Jupiter. You had Ulysses, that one went into a polar orbit around Jupiter, and that one, I mean, it had to go out to Jupiter to do that. You know, use gravity assist from Jupiter for Ulysses to get into that polar orbit around the sun. And then you had, New Horizons, which is still operating. That's the one that went all the way out to Pluto. All these were RTGs. And then you had every one of the landers that went to the moon had RTGs. And, of course, Apollo 13, that was a big... That actually caused a problem. When Apollo 13 came back, the LEM separated from the command module, Aquarius. When the LEM was separated, it was in Earth orbit. They didn't go into orbit. It was a direct shot right into the atmosphere. But the LEM itself wound up burning up inside the orbit of Earth, and inside is an RTG. It's a plutonium that they were going to use for, you know, like all the other flights that went to the moon. They put the package, the astronaut package on the moon that would operate. I think Apollo 12, I think 11 didn't have it. I think 12 through 17 did, which I'm thinking. So that brings you back to Cassini. When Cassini went up, people started bringing up, you know, this was dangerous, what went on with Apollo 13, burning this thing up back in the atmosphere. That was supposed to go out to the moon and stay there. So a lot of people were protesting, a lot of protests that Cassini is, you know, no good. It's going to, if it doesn't get into orbit, it's going to contaminate the Earth. They made a big thing out of it. I remember seeing scenes where they were showing these canisters and they were shooting missiles at it and trying to blow these things up. You couldn't blow these canisters up no matter what you're doing. You couldn't break them open. So finally they got the approval to put it onto a Cassini. And eventually a couple of other ones like New Horizons. And solar panels, the Juno mission, that's going around Jupiter now. That qualified. I mean, they have big panels. I mean, from one end to the other, it's like 120 feet, three of these panels. They're offset like 120 degrees from one another. Three big panels are coming out. And that capability really wasn't there when Galileo went up. So when Galileo went to orbit Jupiter back in the 90s, you know, they didn't consider solar panels, but now they can do that, and they realized how viable it was and how much of a difference it was. When European Space Agency wanted to send Rosetta out to a comet, and a comet was out past Mars at the time, so past the asteroid belt, we dropped it. They thought, maybe, you know, they were nuts to put these solar panels on this Rosetta spacecraft, and it worked out great. They were very large solar panels, so whatever light they needed out of the asteroid belt, I would imagine that. I think Mars is 1.6 AU, and I think the asteroid belt is roughly 2, so, you know, it was like a 4-to-1 ratio for the square area that you would need compared to an Earth. So, you know, you could imagine it. You know, a solar panel is probably 20 feet long here. It would have to be, you know, four times that out of the asteroid belt. But it worked good. It was a very successful mission. So that's two missions with large solar cells that are really working beyond the Mars and asteroid belt. Back to you.
Solar panels are a nice way to go. Didn't I hear you say that the lunar module had an RTG? I thought all of its energy came from a oxygen tank and a, what do you call that, kind of a converter, converts oxygen into water and electricity, fuel cell. I thought that was powered by a fuel cell, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, but all of, yeah, you're right, but the packages that they were supposed to take out for the experiments, the asphalt packages, they put them out on the moon, and one was a seismometer, another one, you know, taking different readings of the dust in the rarefied atmosphere, and all these different things were operated by an RTG on the moon. Like I remember, who was it? Alan Beam said he could feel the heat of this thing when he took it out of it. You know, they had it on the outside of the limb. You know, he went down the ladder, took it off the limb. He could feel the heat right through his gloves. You know, but yeah, on all those landers they had RTGs, except for Apollo 11. They didn't have that for Apollo 11. They had it for the other ones. Pretty sure that was they had a couple of solar panels on that. I remember Buzz Aldrin putting that one out back in the
day. I think you're right. It sounds like the ALSEP packages, ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. It looks like the majority of those were RTG powered. But the very first one on Apollo 11, I don't think they had called them ALSEP yet. And so I think you're saying you believe that was solar powered. And those ALSEP packages, they didn't need very many watts. Was that a smaller version of the RTG? Smaller than, certainly it's going to be smaller than what's on Curiosity. Is it also smaller than what's on any other spacecraft? I guess what the real question is, how many different sizes of RTGs are there? Over to you, Paul.
I read about this years ago, and it was in a couple of different places. I still don't know if it's true, but everyone is supposed to be exactly the same, dating back all those years. They're all the same. 103 watts. Pretty sure that's the number. So per you know setup. So if you want triple that, you want something over 300 watts. Put three of these together like they did on Voyager. If you look at a close-up of Voyager, you can see three of these things sticking out on one of the outriggers that they have.
A real big energy user is either Curiosity or maybe New Horizons. How many RTGs is on Curiosity? I think that's also three.
No, I read they only have one. And that 103, 109 watts, whatever it is, that's it. That's all they use. So this thing stores up a lot of energy if it's not being used. For instance, at night, charging batteries. And it sounds like you would need the energy from the batteries to keep the circuits warm, but it's not. They use the heat from this thing, which is putting out, like, I think 12 or 1300 watts. We'll install all kinds of ductwork or pipe conduit ducting system to keep the different things that it needs to be warm. And the RTG is, it's just one of them, and that's it. And that's it. The new rover, 2020 rover, is also going to have just one. It sticks out of the back. You can see that. It looks like a tail on the back of a new rover.
What's the maximum number of RTGs that has ever been put on any spacecraft? Every one of the RTGs is the exact same model. I thought they had two different sizes. And when it comes to the more modern version that was proposed, a Stirling engine, I read up on that over the week. The Stirling engine, I thought, would be subject to failure because of mechanical parts, you know, a rotating crankshaft, piston rods, whatever. It doesn't work that way at all. It's a double-ended Stirling engine where the piston moves back and forth on a linear lining, so to speak, cylinder lining. the piston is a magnet. It's moving back and forth inside of a coil, and by Faraday's law, it induces voltage into that coil. So it has no sliding mechanical parts. Everything is mechanically suspended. Therefore, it can have a lot more life, and I think it runs two, three, four times more efficient. I think it runs 25% efficiency, as opposed to only a few percent efficiency for the thermal electric generators of U-Pole K2RIW. By the way, I'm going to leave you at 11 o'clock. I want to catch the news. And whether or not you want to continue, it's strictly your choice, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'll probably watch the news as well. Yeah, RTGs are very good, but you're talking about the stirling. The heat from the RTG will still be there, heating the stirling engine, creating power, and then at the same time, they're going to get an extra 103 watts, whatever it is, from the RTG. From direct electrical power. So yeah, that's the combination that they're looking to. They think they could get four times the amount of electricity out of a setup like that with using the Stirling engine compared to, you know, so now you could use the same amount of plutonium for 400 watts instead of 100 watts. I believe that's what you read about.
I sure did, and it sounds awfully attractive efficiency-wise. But I think I also read that the Stirling engine version of the RTG has not yet been approved for production. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, well, as about 6 months ago, it wasn't approved, so it's probably still not approved. You know, it'll probably take a couple of more years before, you know, they may have to test these things, you know. Send it up probably to the space station. You know, they got to make a proof of concept out of it before they. You know, I always say anything invented, it's going to take at least 5 years before it ever winds up in space. It just has such a lot of testing. Acoustics will break apart when it's launched from the vibration, the noise, and solar radiation, magnetic fields like we talked about in the beginning of the net. You know, it's got to go through all this testing before anything gets approved. But once it does, the stuff that they send up is usually pretty good. Look at the 3D printer they got up there. They got two of them now on the International Space Station operating. You know, I mean, it took years to get that thing approved to get up, send up to space. I'll let you go, Dick. Time's ticking away. You got 1 minute before the news. I'll do the same. K2RIW, WS2N.
Very fine, Paul. You guys have heard TechNet number 1667. You just heard Space Report number 267. 73, you all. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW clear.
Very well done, everybody. 73, we'll be back here one more week from now. WS2N clear.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net time complete.
Okay, thanks for the pickup, AC2IS. KD2FIU is standing by here, and actually I'm monitoring an open a Red Cross traffic band on 7262 on 40 meters right now. No traffic, but I'm giving an assist. I thought I'd, you know, drop the call in to say hello, because I'm sitting here with two radios, KD2FIU.
Okay, I thought you might have been trying to check in on the TechNet, which signed off early at 11 p.m. tonight. AC2IS.
No, I wasn't, because I did jump in a couple of times on the TechNet there. KD2FIU operator George over here in Western Queens.
Gotcha. Are you hearing anything on the Red Cross net?
Check-ins for support. I have a very good orientation. I'm actually strung east and west, so I have a southern to northern broadside very well, so I can hear the entire east coast. 80 feet mid-tune with tuning coils at the end, very effective 40 and 80 meter antenna. AC2IS, KD2FIU, did I lose you?
Yeah, sorry, I'm still here. Just have some other things going on at home. I'm usually just listening to the TechNet in the background. Not on the air most of the other times. But glad to hear that you're doing something. Sounds like you said that you were trying to do an assist. I'm not sure what assist you can provide from here by monitoring Red Cross down the East Coast, EC2IS.
Traffic relay. There are people in the Carolinas, there are people in Georgia, people in New York, not New York City, and however, as conditions permit. The thing is that I don't know if any of the antennas in Florida are still standing up.
Yeah, I would think that the Red Cross would focus on setting up shelters and bunkering down during the time the storm itself was passing over, and then standing up communications after the storm passed. So that they could communicate whatever needs there are in each shelter. AC2IS.
Amateur radio does have people who are part of the Red Cross who assist in communications that are not available.
Not sure what you're saying there. I would think that a lot of the communicators would have mobile gear that would not stand up well to the wind, but that could be stood up after the storm passed. Just hope that there's not a severe catastrophe directly at a shelter during the time of the hurricane itself. AC2IS.
I'm not sure. Are you discounting amateur radio's ability to assist?
No. I'm thinking that cell communications could drop out, and ham radio would be very useful in those circumstances. But that, you know, unless they're setting up from indoors, which they could do, seems like the most typical thing would be to, you know, set up your mobile gear outdoors. And that would be easiest to do after the bulk of the wind passed. During the storm itself, if cell tower goes out, cell towers go out, they, you know, like I said, unless people are willing to set up their antennas indoors to avoid being knocked down by the wind, it seems like there might not be any communication options in the middle of a Category 5 AC2IS.
Hey, there's an open communication coming in. 82FIU, I gotta listen to this.
KD2OAX radio check.
KD2OAX, this is AC2IS. Your volume is a little bit low. There's a little light hiss in the background, but you're coming through clear. AC2IS.
Copy that. Alpha Charlie 2, Miss Sierra. This is KD2OAX. Coming in on a homemade antenna from an HD. Where are you coming in from?
I'm coming in from my mobile Go kit, which is set up in my living room right now, with a mag mount that once upon a time was on top of my car, but it's also sitting in my living room. And I'm hitting the eastern repeater, which is just about the only thing I can hit from here. AC2IS.
Yeah, I'm on a little HD antenna. I'm coming out of Brooklyn, New York. You're coming in real nice and clear. And, I've just been zooming through some of the local repeaters on this dipole I put up on my roof. I have an apartment. So I've got a little bit of a reach over a lot of the buildings around me. And I couldn't make the contact with you. So thank you for responding.
You are very welcome. It's good to hear from you. And let's see. Like I said, I'm not on the air all that much, but sure there will be plenty of people to talk to on these repeaters. AC2IS. Hey Stan, my name is Bill, AC2IS.
Copy that, Bill. I got you in AC2IS. This is KD2OAX. I'm going to be monitoring and trying to do some stuff in here, so thank you for the response.
K2RIW, WHCDL. You listening, Dick?
WHCDL, KD2FIU.
Hello, WHCDL. How you doing? Back on the air.
When did you ever leave us, Andy? What? Back on the air. Come on, what happened?
I was back on the air. I was off the air, so now I'm back on. I wasn't on before because I was away. Meaning that I wasn't home. Now I'm home and ready to go to sleep.
Yeah, I am too. I'm kind of burnt. I was Technet 2 radios, listening to the Technet. I guess a couple of comments and monitoring on 40 meters.